Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick, and it is time travel o'clock on Weird House Cinema. Today's movie selection is the 1979 romantic sci-fi adventure Time After Time by the American writer and filmmaker Nicholas Meyer. So this is a movie that I had never seen until this week, and I came across it by way of a plot description in some article I was reading somewhere. I don't even remember what it was now. But I discovered in this article that there was, allegedly, a time travel adventure movie in which the English writer H.G. Wells, real historical figure, author of the novel The Time Machine, played in this movie by Malcolm McDowell, must use a real time machine to chase Jack the Ripper, played by a smooth and sadistic David Warner, through space and time in this time machine to prevent the Ripper from slashing 20th century disco dancers. And the premise was, it sounded so bonkers that I immediately thought this had to be a good option for Weird House. And then the really surprising thing was, the more I read about it, the more it seemed that most critics really liked this movie, even though I had somehow never really heard of it, or if I'd heard about it, it didn't make enough of an impression that I remembered it. So I sought this out, and I got to say, I was really impressed. Now, on the downside, for Weird House context at least, I will say this movie doesn't actually, when you're watching it, feel quite as weird in its execution as a straight read on the premise would lead you to assume. But nevertheless, I think this is mostly just a really great movie, and it opens up all kinds of interesting bigger questions about the themes and ambitions of time travel stories and science fiction in general.
Yeah, I was excited to view this film again, especially after watching Spookies last week, in part because I was excited because you had never seen it, and so that would make it fresh. It's a film that I had not seen in a long time. I remember watching it on TV. I don't know if they used to show it on like TNT or maybe it came on A&E or something back in the day, but I remember watching it on television. And it holds up so well. I've spoken to various people and folks who have seen this movie. They tend to like it. I haven't met anybody who hated it. It's kind of like an Orange Julius, I guess. As long as you just don't really hate orange juice or really hate,
malls or
malls or something. I don't know. Maybe it's a terrible analogy. But I don't know. It's something about this film just seems to sit well with most people. I don't know. Everything's very well calibrated. Like, it's sci-fi, but it's not so sci-fi that it turns off people that would be opposed to, say, rampaging Morlocks. And yet people like us who might say, why are there no Morlocks in this picture? It's still so captivating and well acted and well put together that I ultimately can't argue too much about the results.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would have, of course, enjoyed if it went much weirder and wrapped in more H.G. Wells lore, had Morlocks and all kinds of stuff like that. It doesn't. And in fact, the film is almost the opposite of that. I would say for a science fiction movie involving one of the most notorious sadistic serial killers in history, this is an extremely cozy feeling movie. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
I would agree. I believe this was a PG, but it was a 1979 PG. So
yeah.
I do not recommend watching this with your young children.
Right.
There is blood and there are some mature themes that are explored. But even those mature themes, which are, you know, just part of the tapestry you're invoking by bringing in a character like Jack the Ripper, they are handled in a very light and ultimately kind of comforting way, I guess.
And I think it also helps that, it's funny, I want to criticize myself because I think in a previous episode of Weird House Cinema, I was trying to list actors that just have that evil look that unfortunately just have faces where maybe they can't overcome the fact that they look sadistic and sinister. Uh-huh. And one of the actors I singled out in this regard is Malcolm McDowell. I'm like, it's going to be hard to have Malcolm McDowell as a hero because he just looks like an evil person. That's not a nice thing to say, but for some reason he does. And yet I hadn't seen this movie at the time. In this movie, he's so sweet.
He is. He's very lovable in this. He's a Victorian teddy bear. And he also feels smaller than usual, probably by design, the way they were shooting him and maybe leaning into his actual height a little bit instead of putting him on an apple box or something. It's also fascinating that this was the film that followed up the notorious Caligula, in which he very much played a villain and a nasty character in a nasty film. And apparently that was part of it. He's like, I really don't want to play a villain for once. Can I play the hero of a picture? And yeah, he's great in this.
It's almost hard to imagine the gap that is crossed going from Caligula to this sweet romantic time travel adventure, love story galloping across time. Caligula is a movie that I have tried to watch for badness sake years ago with some friends, and I couldn't make it through the movie. It is just so repulsive and like... It's one of the ugliest movies I've ever seen. The colors hurt the eyes. It's just relentless, depressing violence and depravity. There's one part that's, it would have been funny in a different movie because it's so ridiculous. There's a part where, like, I think Malcolm McDowell is like watching a gigantic lawnmower in ancient Rome just like cut off the heads of people who were buried up to their necks. But the movie is like so depressing, like even that wasn't funny. So it's just, just awful. And then, going from that to this, which is just this spry, sprightly, beautiful time travel adventure.
Yeah. It's quite a leap. But yeah, he's very good in this. And I will say that as Malcolm McDowell aged, I feel like he kind of aged into that face even more, to where it's harder to imagine older Malcolm McDowell playing a likable character, a non-villain. But I say that he's been in so many films, I'm sure he pops up later on playing like a kind grandfatherly character. But also I think he became increasingly typecast as he got older too.
Yeah.
And he's still active. We'll get into his bio in a bit. But yeah, he's still active. So there's still time.
Okay, how about a movie where Malcolm McDowell plays Santa Claus? He could go the Kurt Russell route, you know?
I don't know. I guess the part of the thing is, if you are going to pay out and get Malcolm McDowell to play Santa Claus in your film, then clearly you want villainous Santa Claus. Like, what are you doing? You know, at this point,
One of those Santa Claus is the monster movies, like the one with Goldberg. You remember that one?
I know of it. Yeah.
Well, maybe we should give a little historical context for the premise of this movie, which is, once again, H.G. Wells must pursue Jack the Ripper through time in a time machine to stop him from ripping the 20th century.
Yeah, well, let's let it rip here. So, first of all, what do you need to know about H.G. Wells and the time machine to enjoy this film? Well, not a lot, but here are the basics. Time Machine is an excellent 1895 novel by English writer H.G. Wells, who lived 1866 through 1945. It's a short read, widely available, and in my opinion, it holds up really well. It's a very readable text today.
One thing that's worth noting is that the time this movie is set before H.G. Wells wrote the novel. So so he wrote the novel in 1895. I don't remember exactly the year, but I think this is set in 1891 or 93, something like that. Or the beginning is before they travel through time.
1888, I believe.
Oh, okay.
That would be prime ripping time right there.
Oh, okay. All right.
At any rate, this is not the absolute first time travel yarn. It's an interesting discussion to get in. I think we've talked about this in the show when you try and figure out like who was the first person to deal with time travel. But it was the first time travel story to gain just a huge degree of popularity. And Wells actually coined the term time machine.
Hmm.
Now, to be clear, the character in the book is just the time traveler and is not Wells himself.
I think it's written from a first-person perspective, isn't it?
It is, but yeah. I don't think we're really supposed to assume that Wells made a time machine.
No.
This film, however, takes a different approach. Wells was a futurist, though, in real life. He was not an inventor outside of the invention of sci-fi concepts and the like and the exploration of new ideas. The book has been adapted a few different times, including the famous 1960 George Powell adaptation. This one has a really iconic look for the time machine, wonderful Morlock designs. Like when you think Morlocks, these are the Morlocks you probably picture. But there was also a 1978 TV movie and a 2002 remake that I've seen, and I remember it being all right. But the interesting thing about it is that it was directed by Wells' great grandson, Simon Wells.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's worth seeing it on its own, even if it came out in 2002, which, man, movies from 2002, it is hard to escape that early 2000s look. It just kind of bleeds into everything. I watched a movie from 2002 the other day. It was a really bad but enjoyable Clint Eastwood detective movie from 2002 called Bloodwork. I don't know if you've seen that one.
I have not seen that one.
Well, so, I mean, absolute, like, hack detective story. Hilarious, but also quite fun. And it's got that look. It just, like, everything from 2002 has this, I don't know, this some feature of, like, the contrast and the colors and everything. It just, everything looks kind of slick and awful.
Well, it's been a while since I saw the 2002 Time Machine, but I remember being entertained by it, and I remember that it had Jeremy Irons as a Morlock in it. So,
oh, good choice there.
Yeah, I remember the Morlocks looked pretty good, but then again, I'm generally in on the idea of Morlocks. Hard to break Morlocks for me.
Oh, but one thing that was true about the historical figure H.G. Wells that is also true of the character in the movie is that he was known as something of a kind of progressive utopian socialist and a futurist. So he had a lot of like visions of the future that involved progressive political ideals. I'm not sure if all of the exact things stated by the character in the film would be real things that H.G. Wells thought or would have said, but it's at least sort of in the ballpark.
Right. And then, yeah, ultimately, the film is largely about the idea that if Wells represents optimism for the future coming out of the Victorian age, and ultimately the optimism about what was possible in the Victorian age in the late 1900s, then our other figure represents the worst of that time period, the
right.
notorious character of Jack the Ripper. So what do you need to know about Jack the Ripper? Okay, here are the basics. So in many ways, this is the original true crime sensation and a topic of continued and largely fruitless intrigue today, also referred to as Leather Apron. This was an unidentified serial killer active in London's Whitechapel district around 1888. He targeted underprivileged members of society, generally prostitutes, and was known for the modus operandi of slicing first the throat, then the abdomen, as well as his taunting letters to the media.
Now, one note I do have there is that because this movie set me off on a reading spree where I was like, oh, I need to know things about Jack the Ripper. The letters are one of the most famous things about him, though I think there is serious doubt about the authenticity of all of the letters. I think there's only one letter that historians take seriously at all as possibly being from the killer himself. And this is the so-called From Hell letter, because I think the reason this is the only one that's really taken seriously is that it was accompanied by a jar containing a piece of actual human kidney allegedly taken from one of the victims, though it's not possible to confirm whether it actually came from a victim or not. They didn't have like DNA testing at the time, obviously. And it could have been obtained from a medical college or cadaver or something like that.
Yeah, I believe the police at the time, they suspected, or one of their theories was that that was the origin of the organ, is it came from some sort of a cadaver situation, right, as opposed to a murder victim.
And one of the weird things about it is that the From Hell letter, I will say, just as a literary appraisal of the interest contained in these letters, it's one of the less interesting ones. Like the really interesting letters are the ones that are
Dear
now
Boss
pretty
levels.
Much known to be hoaxes that were sent possibly by like journalists trying to gin up interest in the story further to sell more newspapers.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are some of the more entertaining letters, but also, and you can see why they would have been fabricated, just to sort of drum up this this paranoia and excitement about the murders. They have that, one of them has that line, "I shan't stop ripping."
Right, till I am good and buckled or something.
Yeah. There's a high probability that he didn't write any of these letters, but they are very much associated with him. The idea of this figure that is killing and then mocking the press, that is the subject of all this media and public fear and fascination, but is also potentially feeding it as well and feeding off of it.
Right. And I think it's these letters, even though probably none of them are authentic, or at least most of them are not authentic, it's these letters that sort of create one of the most lasting legacies of Jack the Ripper, which is this idea that he's sort of playing a game of chess with the police, that this is a major part of his motivation. And this does come through in the movie as well, because you see Jack the Ripper in his identity before he's revealed to be Jack the Ripper. He is a friend of H.G. Wells, and they play chess together in the movie. And, you know, he's very into like outsmarting his opponents.
Yeah. Now, there are, I think, just five verified murders, if you will, by Jack the Ripper, though there are others that may or may not be attributed to him, depending on where you're falling. And then likewise, there's a great deal of folklore, fiction, and pseudo-history that just abound within the realm of Ripperology. Mm-hmm. He was never caught, and there are numerous suspects that have been discussed over the years, and they range from the potentially believable to the outrageous, to the unbelievable, even during the time. Some of these suspects did have a surgical background, because there was the whole apparent removal of organs in the murders. And so, you know, some thought, well, this indicates that the individual had some level of training or expertise or familiarity with human anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Time After Time, the Ripper is this character, Dr. John Leslie Stevenson, who is not an historical person, as far as I can tell, but weirdly enough, the 1990s Outer Limit episode Ripper, which stars David Warner and Cary Elwes, was co-written by Leslie Stevens. So there you go. That's enough of a connection for Ripperology, I think.
Wait, is Leslie Stevens a real person and it's just a coincidence, or is this a pseudonym for saying it was like written by David Warner or something?
I mean, it's an IMDb writing credit that's okay. Not David Warner. So I think it's either just somebody who happens to be Leslie Stevens, or it is the actual Jack the Ripper having time traveled to the 90s to make a career for himself in TV screenplay writing.
Okay, so the last week I have been wandering around my house nonstop singing that Cyndi Lauper song. I can't get it out of my head. It is not used in the film. In fact, the song was released after this film came out. Is there any connection between them?
Allegedly, Cyndi Lauper was inspired to write the song because she liked the movie. And weirdly enough, there was in recent history, there was an attempt to bring the novel Time After Time back as a TV series. And each episode of the TV series gets its title from the lyrics to Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time.
Nice, nice. Cyndi Lauper doesn't get enough credit as a songwriter, you know? Have you ever actually listened to the lyrics of Girls Just Want to Have Fun? That's actually like a sort of profound and sad song.
Yeah, yeah. I like some Cyndi Lauper. I haven't really been playing her recently, but yeah, she had a number of hits. I would generally take the Cyndi Lauper songs of that era and put them above the Madonna songs of that era.
Ooh, I don't know if I would go that far, but definitely I'm a fan. And now I have to correct myself because I actually just looked it up to make sure and found out that Cyndi Lauper did not write Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Her version was a cover version. Whoops.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, but great song anyway, and her version is great.
Tired of boring lunches? Picture this. You're at Chipotle ordering the same old burrito bowl. But wait, there's more excitement in store than just guac. Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Just link your card, dine at your favorite restaurants, and you'll earn points to get free gift cards from tons of brands. It's like getting paid to eat. Hungry for savings? Download the Drop app now and use code DROP44 to kickstart your rewards journey with $5 in points.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S., That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
So we've already pretty much done our elevator pitch for Time After Time. Shall we go ahead and listen to just a little bit of the trailer audio? Not the full thing, but just a little bit of the trailer.
Maybe I don't like this trailer. I feel like it really it takes away from the movie. But okay, let's just get a snippet.
The time is 1893, and novelist and inventor H.G. Wells makes a startling announcement.
Gentlemen, I am talking about traveling through time. In a machine constructed for that very purpose.
The first to use the machine, however, is Dr. John Leslie Stevenson. better known to history as Jack the Ripper. Time after time.
Yeah, this is a bad trailer. I hate the comedic trailer narrator who's like, Jack the Ripper is on a vacation. You know, it's like always this kind of like Casey Kasem-esque voice that's like, you're going to have a good time at the theater. And give me the voice of God any day over this nonsense.
The trailer is bad in numerous ways, and I do not recommend watching it. First of all, because of what you're saying, the tone and the narrator are irritating and I think do not accurately communicate the spirit and feeling of the movie. And second, the trailer reveals the entire plot, including the ending. It's one of those awful things. So, like, if you've seen the trailer, the movie is kind of spoiled for you.
Yeah, not a good way to go into this film.
Now, being a time travel movie, one of the things that I was thinking about for this episode is it sort of made me want to create an in-house taxonomy of major types of time travel stories sorted by prevalent themes. And of course, any given movie or story can partake of multiple different time travel themes, multiple of the themes that follow that we're about to talk about. And I'm also sure this list will not be exhaustive. People will probably write in and be like, hey, what about this type of movie? It'll be something I didn't even think about. But I think here are some of the major categories of time travel stories. And we can talk about how Time After Time fits or does not fit into each of them. So the first one I wanted to mention is what I would call the debugging history story. And this is a type of time travel story that focuses primarily on isolating variables of cause and effect in the progression of history and human life. So it's largely concerned with the consequences of decisions and the long-term ripple effects of seemingly minor events and encounters. So this can be seen, for example, in Back to the Future, where Marty McFly learns that certain minor interventions with his parents as teenagers, like he gives his teenage dad a pep talk about standing up for himself and so forth. This radically changes the circumstances of his family 30 years later. Or it can be seen in movies that don't even really feature time travel, but just merely the alteration of past events. An example here might be the final act of It's a Wonderful Life, where George Bailey learns that, you know, if Clarence the Angel tweaks history so that he was never born, everybody else in his life turns out miserable and impoverished, and he sees the impact that his life had. I would actually say that Time After Time does not partake heavily of the debugging history theme, though there are little nods here and there, especially at the ending. Maybe something we could talk about if you want or not, though it's a spoiler for the movie. But this is not the major type we're dealing with in Time After Time.
Yeah, this film, ultimately, the character of Wells is more interested in protecting the future. That's what prompts him to travel through time in the film, or at least not necessarily protecting the actual future, but protecting Wells' idea of the future. So in a sense, the existence of Jack the Ripper even in the late 19th century is a threat to his worldview and vision for change. The idea of Jack the Ripper escaping into his envisioned utopia is a total threat to this idea.
Now, while we're going through and talking about Time After Time, I feel like we should also just run through this list the example of Trancers 2, the other time travel movie we've done.
Yeah, and I think the basic answer is always going to be yes, sort of, maybe, but who knows? Because Trancers is all over the place with time travel and why they're doing it and who's doing it. But I would say yes, Trancers definitely does this, but it's messy.
Okay, that's debugging history. The next major time travel theme, I would say, is Journey to Time Island. This is a time travel story. This is probably one of the least thematically interesting ways of using time travel in a story. And it's a story that uses some time in the future or the past primarily as a hostile setting for adventure. Mm-hmm. So in these stories, the past or the future can be thought of as largely equivalent to physical places like Skull Island or the Forbidden Planet. It's just a dangerous place for the characters to arrive and then face unfamiliar challenges. And I will say Time After Time does not largely fall into this category, but actually H.G. Wells' novel, The Time Machine, is more in this vein.
Yeah, traveling into a distant future, for example, that that definitely is a commentary on the present, or the Victorian present that the author lived in. But also it is just kind of this fantastic place in which to have an adventure.
Right. I think the time machine also partakes largely of another more interesting category we'll get to in a minute.
Now, the time travel, the time island, rather, this idea, I was thinking to myself, okay, well, what's something that falls in line with this? And my mind instantly goes to Ray Bradbury's A Sound of Thunder, though that one is also a debugging history tale to a large extent.
Yes.
Sort of accidental debugging of history.
This is bugging history, inserting bugs in the lines of code of history, yeah.
Yeah, the idea I can go back into dinosaur days and have a safe adventure hunting dinosaurs, but then you find out, no, you cannot. By doing so, you're totally bugging the future.
That's a very good observation. Okay, third category. So we had debugging history, journey to time island. Third one I will say is what I would call fish out of time. This is a time-based equivalent of the standard fish out of water plot, seen most often in comedies, where most of the tension, usually comedic tension, is based on failures of the out-of-place protagonist to understand and adapt to local conditions, expectations, you know, wandering around being confused by surroundings, accidentally violating taboos. So you can think of like Borat, but with time instead of place, or Demolition Man with the three seashells.
Yeah, another example of this would be a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Sure.
You know, where there are a lot of comedic fodder is made on the fact that, oh, this person's out of time. They don't know what this means. And the people that he's around now, they don't know what this means. And hilarity ensues.
And, you know, I will say usually fish out of time is not one of my favorite time travel themes. But Time After Time has a good amount of this. And I loved it in this movie. I would say it works much better in Time After Time than it usually does in other stories of this sort.
Yeah, it really excels at this, often with stuff that on paper just sounds awful. Like the idea, what if H.G. Wells traveled to the late 70s and went to a McDonald's?
Uh-huh.
It sounds awful, but it's great.
It.
It's great. Yeah. That's one of my favorite scenes where he goes into the McDonald's and he's trying to make sense of everything. And then later he's having a meal with the romantic interest and she asks how the food is. And he's like, oh, it's better than the Scottish restaurant where I had breakfast.
McDougal's,
McDougal's. So this film excels at the fish out of time.
Oh, and he gets really excited when he figures out what fries are.
Oh, yeah. He's like, oh, it's pommes frites. Now, as far as transfers goes, I think they did this. Pretty sure they did this.
Yeah.
There was a fair amount of humor in transfers. So it's if you have humor in your time travel scenario, you're probably engaging in this trope.
Okay, the next category is the one, I feel like I need a snappier name for this one, but it's basically what I would call the time travel arms race. And these are the ones that tend to be the most complicated in terms of plotting, and that's because they're the ones that take the premise the most seriously. Like they're thinking really hard about what it would actually be like to have the power to travel back in time. And not just as a means to get the protagonist to an unfamiliar setting, but actually as an ongoing mechanism that can be used over and over, often ultimately as a weapon, something that grants godlike power. Because if you know what's going to happen in advance and you have the power to go back in time and approach any situation differently, you can make almost any situation turn out your way. And so this gives anybody who possesses the power of time travel the temptation to use it for selfish, deceitful, or evil purposes. And so I think these plots often contain both protagonists and antagonists who have the power to travel through time, trying to sort of travel back further and further to gain advantage over one another. So the themes of this would usually include thoughts about weaponry, strategy, tricks, and the dangers of having too much power, especially too much technological power. Good examples of this, I think, would include like the movie Primer. The overarching premise of the Terminator films, though there's not a lot of this mechanic within the movies themselves, Terminator, the setup of each film usually involves some form of the time travel arms race. Mm-hmm. And I guess in terms of more recent movies, you could think about Tenet as a version of this.
All right. Yeah. Now, Trancers, I think definitely Trancers got into this territory because there is the idea that, cult members have gone back in time and they have Trancer armies. And so we need to send Trancer cops back in time to deal with them. So, yeah, Trancers being a high-minded time travel movie definitely gets in on this action.
Though I would say Time After Time has very little of this, and it would have made it an entirely different film in ways that we might mention later when we talk a little bit more about the plot. But I don't really hold this against the movie because it just decided to go in a different direction with the way it structured its story. But Time After Time could have been a completely different film if it had just taken this premise seriously and H.G. Wells had said, okay, I can always just go back one more day in the past and do this instead.
Right, right. Or I guess another thing that could have complicated matters is the question of how many time machines are there, and is the time machine a singular entity or is time travel a technology that may be reproduced? In this film, in Time After Time, there is one time machine, mm-hmm. And there are some interesting plot mechanics that keep it that way. And additionally, nobody has subsequently understood how time travel works. The time machine winds up in a museum in San Francisco and it's fully functional, and nobody has really taken it apart to figure out how it works.
Yeah.
Which if you're going to be really pedantic about it, yeah, it's that's kind of silly, but it works within the context of the film.
Yeah, agreed. So the next category I want to mention is kind of a subcategory because it's more of a category that would apply to usually how a twist at the end of a time travel story. But this is what I would call the have you heard about the fates version. I kind of don't want to list examples of this because by including them in this category, I would usually be spoiling some kind of good twist in the movie. But this is a variation that usually starts with something that looks more like Debugging History or the time travel arms race, only for the protagonist to discover too late that the fates cannot be outrun, and while they thought they were avoiding some bad outcome by going back and changing the past, they in fact were not avoiding it or were even causing it or something to that effect.
Yeah, not so much in this picture. Trancers did not really get into this either. But I will say that it does remind me, and this is not a spoiler, and I'll explain why, but the Stephen King time travel novel 11/22/63 is really good for starters. I highly recommend this book, but it definitely gets into this area early on because there's this idea that, yes, you can travel back into the past via this portal, but once you get there, changing history in any meaningful ways is incredibly difficult because there's a sense that it's like time is this surging river, and to try and divert the river's course, there are forces like not forces with names or faces so much, but like just reality itself will revolt against you. Like everything will go wrong in your attempt to try and change the course of history.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I haven't read that one, but you've tempted me.
Yeah. Basically, say an individual becomes convinced that going back and stopping the assassination of John F. Kennedy will make the world a substantially better place in the future. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's worth it. It's worth basically like a one-way trip to go and see this through. And King explores it in a very long book, but and also it's a love story, mm-hmm. which of course brings us back to this movie. I was wondering as I was watching it, how many subsequent time travel romances would just simply not exist if not for Time After Time? I'm thinking about everything from Outlander to Highlander, which even though Highlander is not about traveling through time via mechanics, it is about immortal characters living outside of their original time and then falling in love. So I feel like this film was probably very influential on this sort of subgenre of time travel fiction.
Oh, well, I think this is another great category we should mention, which is the love across time story, which is Time After Time, I think you could definitely say is an example of. It's a type of love story. You know, it's common in a love story to have people who clearly want to be together, but there's some kind of tension that keeps them apart. And that could be, social expectations. It could be, in romantic comedies, it's often a series of farcical misunderstandings that leads them to fighting each other. But in a lot of more sort of serious and tragic love stories across history, it's often been like separation of time, of space.
space. So, you know, like, like we're from different kingdoms or something and we can't be together for that reason. But there are movies that do this with time travel as well. It's like, well, no, I've got to go back to my time and you don't want to leave your time and so forth.
Yeah. Other times it's the Lady Hawk scenario. It's like you're a hawk during the day. I'm a wolf at night. And we're just not aligned. We can't align.
That's
except during a total eclipse, right?
That's right. Okay, and then one last category I want to mention, because I think this is the one that applies the most to Time After Time. This is the category I would call Fresh Eyes for Bad Eras. Mm. And this is the type of time travel story that is primarily about commenting on the particular features of an age, of the time in which they are set. Usually the present, but often also the future as influenced by the present. And so I think these tend to contain the most social commentary of any of the time travel subgenres. So the time traveler is able to look upon an age such as the present and see it with fresh eyes, noticing things, usually bad things, that the chronolocals have learned to ignore just because they're inured to them. And so Time After Time, actually much like H.G. Wells' actual novel, The Time Machine, partakes heavily of this theme. Tying it back into the novel, The Time Machine itself, apart from it just being a sort of journey to Time Island, it's also very much this one because he was using a dystopian vision of the future to suggest that such a future would follow from negative trends that existed in his present. So he's commenting on the present by suggesting a horrible future. But in Time After Time, it's just looking directly at the present. And I think this is one of the most interesting ideas in the movie. So it takes these two time travelers from 1890s London. So H.G. Wells, who the character in the film is a progressive utopian socialist in 1890s London. He believes that humanity will pretty soon advance to a golden age of peace and prosperity and egalitarianism, where there will be no war, no violence, no inequality, no oppression, and so forth. And then the other is Jack the Ripper, who is sort of the embodiment of violent, sadistic, misogynist id. And what if these two figures suddenly got a look at the world in 1979 without having a chance to get used to it as time progresses slowly in the normal sense? What would they think? So, of course, there's a scene in the present where Jack the Ripper turns on a TV and he just starts flipping channels for Wells to see what's on. And it's just scene after scene, both real and fictional, of hatred, violence, murder, war, terrorism, nuclear escalation, full contact football. And Wells is horrified to see that his utopian dreams were hopelessly naive. And the Ripper is just like, yes, good. War, football, I am home.
This is a lovely scene, taking place in Jack the Ripper's hotel room. That's a little messy because he's been staying there. He hasn't been ripping there, but he's been staying there. He has this line, he has several lines that really drive this home, but one of them is, 90 years ago, I was a freak. Today, I'm an amateur.
That's right.
And there's so much to love in this. Some of the little things, like when he turns on the TV, he's clearly at ease in this world. He's wearing the suit of the day, of the time period. He's largely acclimatized to the late 1970s at this point. But then he holds the remote control in a really weird fashion to turn on the TV, which is a great touch. You know, it's like because this character, he's like, I feel the spirit of this age, but I'm not altogether on the technology just yet.
Yeah, it's great. And there are all these little things in the movie that signal this as it goes on, that there's an irony where H.G. Wells is the progressive futurist. And the age that he travels to does include a lot of the ideals he believed in. Like, he is pleased to discover that women have more rights now than they did in his time and so forth. But there's this irony because he, for some reason, doesn't feel comfortable and easy to adapt to the culture of the future in the way that Jack the Ripper does.
Yeah. The treatment of the Ripper in this, it reminds me a lot of the ideas that Alan Moore would later explore in his now classic graphic novel From Hell about Jack the Ripper, in which the Ripper is presented as the dark, embodiment of the Victorian age and ultimately the beginning of the 20th century, a kind of prophet of the modern age to follow. Now, needless to say, that's a much darker treatment, and our Ripper in this film does not see himself as such a grandiose figure. He simply shan't stop ripping, and this is an even better age in which to do it, but he, like that line above that we mentioned implies, he feels like the world has ultimately passed him by. It's not only met his spirit, but it has surpassed his spirit. But he's happy to live in this age,
right? And so one could take this in a kind of simplistic way and say that, well, maybe the movie is just engaging in the sort of naive pessimism, the pessimistic bias that makes people always think that times are just the worst they've ever been. Things are always getting worse. The hell in a handbasket thinking. Mm-hmm. And I would say the movie actually doesn't quite do that. It pretty frequently acknowledges things that in Wells' view are better about the present than they were in Wells' time. But there's also something off about the modern age, especially something about the sort of indifference to violence and the sort of callousness of the modern world that the Ripper finds very welcoming.
What is the headline in the newspaper that he picks up about? It's a sports headline. It's like Rams massacre Colts or something like that.
Yeah, it was Rams maul Colts or something.
Yeah, which I love that. That's a great one of many great moments in the film where it's like, yeah, that headline is just insane. It implies outside of the modern sports understanding of it that herbivores are tearing each other apart in the streets. You know, like we're living in like a biblically misaligned age.
Yeah, and so I don't know. I appreciate the interesting complexity of the feeling that it has about the present, that like some things have definitely progressed and gotten better since the time that Wells is used to, but there are other things that are just sort of like always new sicknesses that continually emerge throughout history, and there's something going on with a kind of inurement to violence and hatred that just is pervasive in the modern world.
And I think a lot of this is exemplified by the setting, because, you know, I like the idea of setting it in the United States, even though it, you know, it begins in what is supposed to be London. Mm-hmm. But you could have easily, you could imagine someone arguing, well, let's set this in 70s New York, you know, just straight to Hell City. Mm-hmm. But no, you go to San Francisco, and their treatment of San Francisco is this kind of almost 50-50 split of seedier elements and seedier parts of town. But also you have so many... you have a lot of time in the film to admire sort of modern late 70s architecture in San Francisco, to walk through the parks and in public spaces. So I think it's a nice balance that's achieved through the setting. And ultimately, the film is like a, in a way, it's like a, it makes you want to visit San Francisco. It's like a, yeah, like a tourism brochure for the city.
They spend a lot of time wandering around the Pan American Exposition buildings, mm-hmm. Which is funny because he's, you know, Wells is admiring them, and Mary Steenburgen's character, I think she has to break his heart and inform him that they're made of plaster.
Yeah. Yeah, he asks if they're made of marble, and she says no, plaster.
But is that actually worse? I don't know.
Yeah.
But they are beautiful to look at.
Is getting gas at Chevron burning a hole in your wallet? What if I told you can easily earn cash back while you fill up? Introducing Drop, the app that turns every fill up into a reward. With Drop, you'll earn points to get free gift cards every time you fill up your tank. Download Drop and use code DROP77 to instantly receive $5 in points to jumpstart your savings journey. Don't miss out on turning your gas expenses into something rewarding.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Since I guess it's time to jump into the connections anyway, I just wanted to flag a strange fact, which is that, okay, so this movie was directed and at least in part written by Nicholas Meyer. I know it was based on a novel, and I think there are multiple story credits for the movie. But Nicholas Meyer, the director, and he wrote the screenplay at least, or was one of the writers. He made this movie, which is about H.G. Wells and Jack the Ripper traveling through time to 1979 San Francisco. And Nicholas Meyer also was one of the writers of Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, which involves time traveling to present day San Francisco, but from the future instead of the past. Interesting.
He knows what he likes.
Yeah.
So Nicholas Meyer was born in 1945, an American writer and director who first made a splash with the 1974 Sherlock Holmes novel, The 7% Solution, in which Sigmund Freud helps Sherlock Holmes battle his drug addiction.
Interesting.
Meyer wrote the screenplay for then the 1976 film adaptation that starred Nicole Williamson, Robert Duvall, Alan Arkin, and Laurence Olivier, as well as Charles Grey and Samantha Eggar. It was a big hit. Meyer wrote more Holmes novels and then went on to direct this film in 1979, followed by Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan in 1982 and Star Trek The Undiscovered Country in 1991, among other films. But those were the big ones.
One interesting thing about Nicholas Meyer as a filmmaker was that he was also behind the 1983 TV special or TV movie The Day After, which was a supposedly factual look at the possibilities of nuclear war, like what if the Cold War went hot. It's hard to tell exactly how influential it was, but it has been alleged that this TV movie was pretty influential even at like high levels of government and changed the thinking of some military and political officials about antagonism in the Cold War.
Oh, wow. Now, he also wrote a number of screenplays, including but not limited to Star Trek The Voyage Home, The Human Stain, and the pilot episode for the 2017 TV series Time After Time, which we alluded to earlier, which I have not seen it. It may be great, but just looking at stills, it looks like it asks the question, what if Time After Time but hunkier?
Yeah, it's got some very square jaw lines.
Mm-hmm. So ultimately, Nicholas Meyer, Saturn Award winner, and he's been nominated for both an Academy Award and three Emmys.
But if I understand correctly, this movie, much like 2001 A Space Odyssey, was one of the rare cases where a movie based on a book is being completed simultaneously to the completion of the book.
That's right. And this leads us to the writer Carl Alexander. This is the son of William Tunberg, who wrote the screenplay for Old Yeller, and the nephew of Carl Tunberg, who wrote the screenplay for Ben-Hur. This was his first novel, Time After Time, though the book was actually optioned before it was completed by Nicholas Meyer, who happened to be a friend of Alexander's, who, you know, had heard him talking about it and had, I think, looked at part of the novel before it was completed. Mm-hmm. And so he was like, this is it. I want this to be my next film. So the film is finished alongside the book. The book and the film were being completed at the same time.
Interesting. Yeah.
He went on to follow this up with a sequel novel in 2019, or at least it published in 2019. I'm not sure if someone else had to finish it for him or how it worked out with the manuscript, because he lived 1938 through 2015. So he would not have lived to see Jacqueline the Ripper published in 2019. Now, the writer Steve Hayes also has a story credit on this, born 1931. Again, I think this comes back to the fact that the screenplay and the novel were essentially being completed at the same time. Mm-hmm. Hayes did a lot of TV writing, including for at least two series that I wasn't familiar with based on popular 80s action films: Conan, which ran 97 through 98, and Rambo from 1986, which I got excited about and then realized that it was a cartoon. But then also, I find that weird that we decided Rambo needed to be a cartoon.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a Conan or a Rambo TV series.
All right, well, let's come back to Malcolm McDowell, who plays H.G. Wells in this. Born in 1943, and this is a guy where it's hard to even figure out where to begin. Legendary British actor who played Alex in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange in 1971. Again, he was in the notorious 1979 film Caligula, which came right before this one. He was in 82's Cat People. I fondly remember him from a child watching 1983's Blue Thunder. He plays the villain in that, who flies this little helicopter that battles our big combat police helicopter that is Blue Thunder.
Oh, boy.
I do not know why.
Gotta love a helicopter battle movie. How many are there? And I remember there's one called, I think, Firebirds that has maybe Charlie Sheen or somebody in it.
I think so, yeah. This one, I have no idea how big of a splash Blue Thunder was at all, but it was big for me as a kid because my aunt had taped some films off of HBO. This was one of them. And it was probably inappropriate for me to be watching it, but I mainly watched it for the helicopter combat scenarios, and then I would build the helicopters out of Legos and have them crash into each other.
That's great. I was wrong, actually. It wasn't Charlie Sheen. It was Nicolas Cage who was in Firebirds.
Oh, okay.
Firebirds was one of those bad action movies that I taped off TV when I was a kid, because I was like, looks like this will be a military action movie. I'm a boy in East Tennessee. This is the kind of movie I'm supposed to be watching. Not great.
So Malcolm McDowell, like we said, he continues to work a lot in films and TV. We can't mention everything he's been in before. I believe he's come up on the show before, not maybe in a film that we've watched, but in, you know, the various connections. But he played Dr. Loomis in both of Rob Zombie's Halloween films, mm-hmm. Which I have not seen, but I'm assuming he's villainous in those.
He looks villainous because Malcolm McDowell usually does, though he doesn't in Time After Time. I don't know how exactly they accomplished that. Maybe with the careful use of hairstyling and facial hair. No, he's not villainous in the Rob Zombie Halloween movies. He's just not super helpful.
Ah. Now, one of the interesting things about Malcolm McDowell in this film is that this is where he met his second wife, Mary Steenburgen, who plays the character Amy Robbins, born 1953. They apparently met on this film, fell in love on this film, were subsequently married, and their son is Charlie McDowell, or one of their children anyway, is Charlie McDowell, who is a director who directed the excellent 2014 film, The One I Love.
Mary Steenburgen is also great in this. She has a kind of funny, nervous energy in the movie, and she's of course great as a comic actress. She essentially, would you say that you think she was sort of playing a similar character in this to the character she plays in Back to the Future 3?
I guess so. Back to the Future 3 is one of those films that I think most people only see once, so I don't really remember her all that. I remember the basics of the character, but I don't know how closely they align with this.
Right. But, I was just thinking Back to the Future 3 had to in part be based on or partially derived from her role in Time After Time.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, because ultimately, I think most time travel romance novels or films or TV shows have to at least in some way look back to Time After Time. It feels very influential.
But yeah, she, I think it took me a while to figure out that she is so good as a comic actress, because I think I recall the first role in which I really became familiar with her was as like a nefarious lawyer defending the bad company in Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
You remember that?
I it's been a long time. I think I saw that many years ago.
Well, yeah, I think she plays a ruthless lawyer who's defending the company that's being sued, and she has like cruel scenes where she grills Tom Hanks on the stand. But that was before I'd seen her really in any comedy stuff, and she's great in comedies. She's great in Step Brothers, where mm-hmm. Will Ferrell is her son, I think, and well, you know, it makes me wonder, is Will Ferrell her son with H.G. Wells from this movie?
I always enjoy her when she often pops up in various comedy things that her husband, Ted Danson, is in. And so she's been very funny in some of those films. I remember she was an Elf and had a pretty fun role in that. But ultimately, Academy Award-winning actor here with Mary Steenburgen here. And she's pretty good in this. Yeah, it's an interesting role because she's called upon in, I think, her only second screen presence to play the modern woman. To represent not only the modern woman from the film's perspective, but the future woman, the woman of the future from H.G. Wells' perspective. So it's kind of a it mostly holds up today. There are certainly some choices here and there where you're like, well, I think they would inevitably do that differently if you were to create this again in like 2020 or 2021. But
I would say those are not choices on Mary Steenburgen's
part. No, not
part.
At all. That's the
things
writing.
In the script. There are some, like, it is ironic that some of the parts of this movie that the movie clearly regards as the most illustrative of the culture of the modern world are exactly the ones that have aged the most poorly. Like there's a scene where Mary Steenburgen's character is casually using offensive language to refer to lesbians. Like, she says the D word. I assumed that word was considered derogatory at the time. I think it was. And she talks about how she does want to pursue her own career ambitions, but she offers the disclaimer that I'm not women's lib. It's just, yeah.
Well, she also echoes this idea that one's work should be your life, and that that's like a healthy choice for the modern professional.
Yeah.
As if, like, ultimately Jack the Ripper's main flaw is that he's making too much time for his hobbies.
Right. Yeah. I do think it's interesting, though, in this film that's like comparing these, you know, different expectations for how the future will turn out, especially with regards to things like moral values and all that, that like some of the things that are considered the most like sort of textural illustrations of how people think in the modern world are some of the things that have aged the worst.
Yeah, that is interesting. But again, ultimately, this is the writing, nothing on Mary. Mary's great in this.
True.
All right, let's get to our Ripper. Let's talk a little bit about the actor who plays Dr. John Leslie Stevenson, a.k.a. Ooh. Jack the Ripper. This is the legendary David Warner.
David Warner is fantastic in this.
Yes, yeah, he is great. Warner, born 1941, as of this recording, still around and either still active or was still active to a limited degree as of like 2020. I'm not sure, especially when you're dealing with older individuals like this. I don't know if he has effectively retired at this point or he's, you know, going to come back and do some more voice acting. But he, like McDowell, has been in just everything twice. He has 225 acting credits on IMDb. He has done theater. He has done audio dramas. He seems like a guy who has just constantly been working through, you know, just nonstop throughout his whole career.
Yeah.
And like McDowell, he also has a real knack for playing villains and has played some really notable ones. He was in Titanic. He was in Tron, Time Bandits.
Oh.
Yeah, he was in Star Trek, The Undiscovered Country. Also popped up on some key episodes of Trek television series, including the one where the Romulan tortures Picard. I'm sorry, not a Romulan. It's a Cardassian. What are they?
I don't know.
Not a Kardashian.
Cardassians?
Cardassian, yes, the Cardassians. Okay. He plays a Cardassian in that, and a Cardassian interrogator. And he is torturing Picard and trying him to like break him. Very memorable episode.
Speaking of being in time travel movies, ooh, I love him in Time Bandits. He plays the villain in Time Bandits. He's the embodiment of evil. He's sort of the devil. Mm-hmm. But he is obsessed with technology in Time Bandits, which I think has some sort of satirical content. But like a lot of things in Time Bandits and Terry Gilliam movies more generally, and it's a thing that I like. A lot of times the satire is not super clear. It's satirical in a kind of vague way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love that the devil, like he seems to not really understand what subscriber try dialing is, but he really wants to know about it. And he really wants to know about, about computers and things.
Oh, I need to watch that one again.
Yeah.
So David Warner is an actor who's been in way too many things to list here, but I thought I might mention some of my additional favorite roles that he's had, and I think all of these are roles where he doesn't necessarily play a villain. He has a role in John Carpenter's In the Mouth of Madness. He plays the head of the Assassin's Guild and the Hogfather. And, oh, most memorably, he plays both a good guy and a bad guy in The Quest of the Delta Knights.
I don't know that movie.
Oh, my goodness. So The Quest of the Delta Knights is this low-budget, Renfesty fantasy yarn. It was used on Mystery Science Theater 3000, so it was riffed on that Ooh. Show. And it's a strong Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode, as I recall. The thing I love about it is that it's not something that comes to mind as a good David Warner film. But there was a fabulous interview with David Warner on the AV Club by Will Harris with David Warner. This was in 2017, where they basically just run through and ask him about various films that he was in. And, what kind of stories do you have from this picture? What kind of stories do you have from this picture? And they asked him about The Quest of the Delta Knights, and he responded with this. Wow. Well, that was, of course, a low-budget film, which what's that called? Mystery Science Theater? It ended up there. Laughs. But I had great fun doing it, playing two parts. Originally, I was just asked to play the one part. And I said, would it save you money if I played two parts for the same money? And they said, yes. So I had great fun changing from a black wig into a gray wig and putting brown contact lenses into my normal blue eyes. It was great fun logistically. So I have great affection for that little low budget film. I've always loved that. Oh. This idea that this film that we think of as being bad and forgettable for an actor of David Warner's pedigree, he's like, no, that was tremendous fun. I'm so glad I did that picture.
Wonderful.
In that same interview, he also mentions that when it comes to Time After Time, the studio wanted Mick Jagger for this role. But the filmmakers were like, no, we don't want Mick Jagger. We really want David Warner. And they fought for David Warner. And thank God they got him.
Yeah. Because you had to save Mick Jagger for Free Jack.
I think Free Jack shows us everything we need to know. I'm not saying Mick Jagger would have made a bad Jack the Ripper, but I don't think he would have been he would not have been a very good Jack the Ripper. Let's just leave it there.
I like David Warner. Yes. I'm glad we got David Warner.
Yeah, he's great in this.
Get the mate.
That's your Mick Jagger, though. That's not your David Warner.
Right, no.
Our Ripper in this film, Dr. Stevenson.
Gets the meat, yeah.
He's very, very stern, but at times he has a sardonic wit to him. It's a great role, and he has a lot of great lines in it. It's a very interesting villain, and ultimately I think this may be my favorite take on Jack the Ripper. I mean, Jack the Ripper is a character that doesn't automatically mean great film presence, but I think Warner's terrific in this film.
You know what I also love Warner in is Tron, where there's a thing in Tron where the same actor will usually play a character in the real world in meat space, but then also play a character within the digital world. And so David Warner does. He's like a sort of corrupt software business leader guy. I think he steals somebody's ideas for some video games or something in the real world. But then within the computer world, he plays the villain Sark, who is this evil, frisbee player who works for the Master Control Program. If you haven't seen the old Tron, it's worth seeing for a number of reasons, but David Warner is a great villain in it.
Oh, yes, he's great. I mentioned that 90s Outer Limits episode that has about Jack the Ripper. I watched it last night, so I just have to share real quick. It's titled Ripper, And it's pretty fun. It may be a little long, like the episode is longer than the premise demands, but it's pretty great. Cary Elwes is in it, but also Francis Fisher and Frantz Nguyen of Death Moon fame, or at least for us of Death Moon fame. I don't think anybody is actually of Death Moon fame, but it's got a fun cast, and the premise is essentially this. What if the Jack the Ripper murders were not due to a human killer, but were due to some sort of an alien space snake that goes that travels into people's mouths and then emerges from their bellies, thus creating the abdominal wounds associated with the Jack the Ripper killings?
Wow.
Yeah. So
does David Warner play the snake?
No, David Warner plays a Scotland Yard investigator, and Cary Elwes plays a former doctor turned opium and he's an opium addict, but also he's drinking too much absinthe and is just generally depressed and sweaty all the time. There's a lot of great overacting from him, like just the right level of overacting, the type of overacting you want from Cary Elwes.
Okay, well, I guess I got to see that one. Maybe it'll come up in a future anthology episode.
Tired of boring lunches? Picture this. You're at Chipotle ordering the same old burrito bowl. But wait, there's more excitement in store than just guac. Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Just link your card, dine at your favorite restaurants, and you'll earn points to get free gift cards from tons of brands. It's like getting paid to eat. Hungry for savings? Download the Drop app now and use code DROP44 to kickstart your rewards journey with $5 in points.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right. As far as other people in the film, like, these are really the three main characters. I'm not sure how many of these other individuals we need to go into. Some of them are only in it briefly.
Uh-huh. There are some cameos that, mm-hmm. that pop out. Corey Feldman shows up as a child. Yep. I don't think he has any lines, but I just saw him and I was like, wait, that's Corey Feldman. And then he just walks off screen.
He may say something like, look, Mom, a time machine or something like that. Man's in. Uh-huh. I don't know. He maybe says something, but yeah, this was his film debut.
Wow.
Another film debut, I believe this was at least his first credit, film screen credit, is M.C. Gainey, who just plays one of the London Bobbies. But this is an actor born 1948. You may not envision him in your mind when I say his name, but if you look him up, you'll be like, oh, that guy, because he's a character actor frequently cast as rotund creepers, bikers, and bad cops.
Think about the pilot of the plane in Con Air.
That's right. That was him. Now, I usually pinpoint the music, and I should pinpoint the music in this one as well. It is a score by Miklos Rosa, who lived 1907 through 1995. So if you're watching this and the score to this film feels very traditional, well, that's because Rosa cut his teeth on film scores in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. He was a Hungarian-American child prodigy. His earliest successes included The Four Feathers in 1939 and The Thief of Baghdad in 1940. He earned 17 Academy Award nominations, including three Oscars for Spellbound in 45, A Double Life in 47, and Ben-Hur in 59. So, huge name in the score business in the golden age of Hollywood. He composed a good 100 scores and also maintained a career as a concert composer. So, even though it's not the sort of film score that I would personally want to listen to outside of the viewing experience, mm-hmm. It's a fine score by a legendary composer.
It is a non-synth score that you will allow.
Yes, yeah, I will allow it.
So I guess we're getting kind of close to the end here. It doesn't make a lot of sense, I think, for this one to talk in much detail about the plot or scene by scene. But I mean, broadly, the main thing is you have this setup where you establish the characters in the 1890s, and then there is invocation of the time travel mechanism. So Jack mm-hmm. the Ripper escapes to the future, and H.G. Wells realizes what has happened, realizes that his friend is in fact Jack the Ripper, has escaped to the future using his time machine that he invented, and now it's his responsibility to track him down and bring him to justice. So that's one half of the plot, is this sort of chase through time, and then the other half is broadly the love story. When H.G. Mm-hmm. Wells arrives in the future, he and Mary Steenburgen, they meet each other at a bank because he is trying to exchange 100-year-old British pounds for money that he can use to buy pomfrits at McDougal's. And she is working there at the currency exchange. They meet and they fall in love, and there's a very sweet love story that develops between them as the plot goes on, and the threat of Jack the Ripper is sort of looming in the background. But apart from that, I mean, I guess drawing on the themes, I think one thing that's interesting in this movie is it's very pointed about H.G. Wells' reaction, his extreme resistance to arming himself with weapons in his mm-hmm. struggle against Jack the Ripper. Like when he goes to try to apprehend him at first, he doesn't arm himself or try to use force in any way. He just goes and tries to talk him into coming back with him. Mm-hmm. And even later on, as the threat becomes more and more dire, it's only at a point of sort of like breakdown and extremity that he finally gets a gun. Something that he's been urged to do, I think, by Mary Steenburgen and maybe other characters before that time. And I wondered what you thought about that. It was an interesting decision to make this character who's so almost irrationally resistant to using weapons or arming himself.
Yeah, that I did wonder at that point in the film, like what it was ultimately supposed to mean. Like maybe, I guess it was probably more about the character and the necessity of the plot. Like it may be one of those situations where you're like, okay, he's in a life and death struggle. Surely he would break and get some sort of a weapon at this point. Mm-hmm. And then it also helps with the whole situation where the police have apprehended him and they find him not only behaving suspiciously, but also armed. So I guess it has its role in the plot. I struggled to get anything more significant out of it personally.
Well, I mean, I think it probably has something to do with like his utopian ideal, because Wells is imagining, you know, his character and the actual H.G. Wells in the late 19th century, like, was a member of the Fabian Society and mm-hmm. did think that, you know, that incrementalist change in a progressive direction would eventually eliminate war and poverty and all that kind of stuff. And so if he's thinking of the utopian ideal, I mean, it seems that he is committed to the utopian ideal of nonviolence in a way that even could be very self-destructive and could be seen as irrational in this case, is where, like, clearly he's dealing with, like, a dangerous killer one-on-one.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that the time when he breaks this is in a moment of weakness. It's when he's sort of, like, lost it.
True, true. Yeah.
But I thought that also had interesting implications, and I don't want to spoil anything, but for how the conflict is finally resolved in the end.
Another point I would make about the time machine, because I step into a movie like this and I expect to sort of geek out about the particulars of time travel a bit. And It's interesting because if you ask me to explain exactly how the time machine works, and I'm not talking about like the power system and all, it's supposed to be like solar powered or something, but there's
solar powered, even though it's in his basement. Yeah.
Right. but there's this whole bit about the different keys that make it do different things. Mm-hmm. And I cannot tell you how these exactly worked. But the film, the film screenplay and presentation is so effective that you don't really have to think too much about it.
Right.
It's almost like the whole situation where it's like you have to try and draw a bicycle. You have this vision of the bicycle in your head and you think you understand it, but then you really don't, not enough to draw it. I feel like that's how the time machine functions in this plot. Like it works. I understand how it functions in the plot and ultimately in the climax of the picture. But I also would struggle to explain how these keys work and which one does what.
That's one type of writing skill. I mean, one good quality of writing is writing that gives you the illusion of explanatory depth. I mean, most stories that you enjoy, you probably couldn't go through and explain in the same level of detail as the author why exactly everything happens and stuff. But there's a sort of ease you settle into with certain types of storytelling, with good writing and all that, where you just kind of like forget about it, you don't worry about it, and you accept that everything makes sense, even when it often doesn't. And I mean, and one way in which it doesn't that I wanted to bring up is how this movie does not get into the archetype of the time travel story, the arms race that I was talking about earlier. And I was thinking about how different the movie could have been if it had embraced that ethic. So when Jack the Ripper flees to the future, the way H.G. Wells decides to deal with it is he's going to go to the same time in the future and bring him back instead of going one day in the past and preventing Jack the Ripper from stealing his time machine in the first place.
Yeah, like that might have been a wiser choice, but it wouldn't have made for as fun of motion picture.
Yeah, just different storytelling sensibilities. And ultimately, I mean, I think it comes down to what is it that the storyteller really wants us to think about. In this case, I think they want us to think about the qualities of the present age in which the movie was made, sort of the arc of history and how that would be sort of metabolized by somebody from the past with utopian ideals and things like that. And it wants to tell that kind of story more than it wants to tell the kind of story about the power that would be granted by a time machine and how people would use that power.
Yeah, yeah. My final note on this film is that there's a scene later on where H.G. Wells is using a phone booth. Oh, wait, let me back up. Another great point in this film where I was laughing out loud and disturbing my wife while she was trying to work in the next room. It was the whole scene with the garbage disposal. Like there's a scene where somebody goes to use a garbage disposal and you just see the hand. It turns out it's not H.G. Wells. But you're like, oh, no, don't let H.G. Wells use the garbage disposal. Mm-hmm. He is not ready for this technology.
Very good point. Yeah, and he's repeatedly confused by phones, though he eventually gets the hang of them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a great part where he goes to a telephone booth and there's some like graffiti that I think is supposed to display the sort of like violence and callousness of the age.
Yes. It says eat razor blades, which is great because it's one of the, I love it when movie graffiti is like clearly orchestrated. It doesn't feel like an organic, bit of legit graffiti art from the age, like this is the prop department, but it feels perfect for this film. Like it feels in line with the sort of worries about the future and the present that are inherent in this tale of Jack the Ripper traveling through time.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're going to probably go ahead and close it out here. Obviously, we'd love to hear from everyone out there. If you have not seen Time After Time, well, lucky you, it's widely available on disc and as a digital purchase or rental or a physical rental if you have a video store like, say, Videodrome in your area. As of this recording, it's currently streaming on HBO Max in the U.S., So if you sign into the app, if you use that service, you can skip all the Mortal Kombat and Suicide Squad stuff. Go right to the classics. They really have a great selection of older films on there.
Oh yeah, I've lately been impressed by the selection of older movies on HBO Max. Thumbs up on that.
In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Weird House Cinema, you'll find it on Fridays in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're primarily a science podcast, but on Fridays we put aside most of the science discussion. I guess there's been more of it in here since we're talking about time travel. But generally, Fridays, those are our days to just talk about weird films, and thus here we are.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Your new home journey starts at Fisher Homes, where everything is red, white, and new. Explore exclusive summer savings and start your journey by selecting your ideal home site and your dream community. Choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans and bring your style to life at the Lifestyle Design Center. Are you looking for a quick move-in ready home instead? Fisher Homes has options for those too. Fill out a form to connect with a new home advisor at fisherhomes.com to get started today before the sun sets on summer savings.
Have you ever wondered what it would be like to have supervision, enhanced hearing, extraordinary reflexes, to be, dare we say, superhuman? Well, Roku's new Pro Series TV can't do any of that for you. But with a 4K screen, side-firing speakers, and a blazing fast refresh rate, it'll sure feel like it. Elevate your entertainment using all your favorite apps like iHeart and play all your music, radio, and podcasts with the new Roku Pro Series. Your senses aren't better. Your TV is.